Lamar.
Mackenzie.
I hope you get where I'm going with that.
It's a very wuthering voice.
It's a wuthering voice.
I had to Google what wuthering means. I had never looked it up until now. It just means very windy, which, you know, I get it. Makes sense in the context of the film.
There's a lot of wind. A lot of wind going down.
It's just such a funny thing to name the book Emily Bronte. Like, so there's
windy
this
heights.
It's very windy. What's the rest? I don't know. We're starting there. I will figure out the rest of the plot as I go. Yeah.
Wind was a gothic motif, and Emily Bronte was a gothic writer. You have to understand. It's a big deal.
She was like a goth chick before it was a thing.
For sure. Her and her sisters, they were such a goth vibe, for
she
sure.
She crushed it on OnlyFans, I feel like.
Leave it to you to take it there. Leave it to you Same. To take it there. Okay. So I have a question for you this week. I thought could be fun. So last week, obviously, we established we're doing Love Stinks Month. So we wanted to stick with, you know, some like love related questions. So I have a little lovey dovey question for you. You ready?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What's something you used to believe about relationships, but you no longer do?
Something I used. We are getting deep in Love Stinks Month. I thought that was the point, was to not have to talk about this shit during this month.
It could be a really bitter answer. You never know.
I feel like my answer is going to be honest and a little bittersweet, but I think it's just it's something that I probably would have liked to have learned. Maybe not known from an earlier age, but it is something I think you learn as you grow up. And that's that I don't believe in necessarily soulmates anymore. I think when I was young, I believed it's like there's one literal person in the universe who you are meant to be with. I think I did.
I love that,
that
you opened it
younger.
Up to the universe, by the way. Like, yeah, all the aliens
we
too.
Talked about aliens during Arrival. Like, who knows? Could be any species, but don't take that the wrong way, guys. I don't want to. Like, that's not the lesson of this pod.
We're cutting it. Yeah. Don't worry.
But I don't necessarily believe. I think you are not looking for a perfect person. I think you're looking for the perfect person for you. And what I mean by that is that I think as I've gotten older and like I've seen what works in relationships and what doesn't, I think you realize that it's not perfect. It's not literally every day is bliss. Not to say that it's like every other day is horrible. That's not what I mean. But it's like, it's a lot of just being around each other and spending time together. And not every moment is super meaningful or passionate. It's more like this coexistence of two people who just make a lot of sense together and you support each other. And it's, I think this is coming from a place of being in the most mature relationship I've ever been, not just age-wise, but just the way that you get on. And it's like, occasionally you're going to have fights, and that doesn't mean you're not good for each other. The fact that you can talk your way through that of how each person is feeling and understand that you don't have to agree on things, but that you still want to be together tomorrow is something I don't think I would have thought in my youth or even in my 20s. I would have been like, this is too much drama. We're fighting. We have to break up. And I think as you get older, you realize like, oh, I found somebody who really does get me in a lot of ways that no one else has to this point. So that would be my big takeaway is like, I don't believe in soulmates, but I believe that there is somebody who makes a lot of sense for you. And you have to like realize when that's the case.
Yeah. Like true love is not a movie or a rom-com.
Right.
It's like a partnership. It's a partner that compliments you and that you love in a different way. Yeah.
Well, dude, we did Blue Valentine last year. If you guys haven't seen that movie or listened to that episode, that is what happens after the rom-com ends.
Right. Yeah. Right. 100%. 100%.
What about you?
Yeah. Yeah. I think these are going to turn out much more sincere than I thought they would, I guess. I think what I have learned is that love is not limited. And by that I mean is like when you love someone a certain way, I think when I was younger, I thought that that was the only way, right? You either have a romantic love or like these big sweeping dramatic love stories, or they're just your friend, or they're just, you know, they're just family, whatever it is, like it's limited. They have their pockets. They have their intentions and their purposes. And especially in relationships where you are falling out of love, feeling like if you let that go, that that's the only way to have loved that person, that you can't love that person in a different way. It's only this romantic love. And if you're letting go of that romantic love, then you're letting go of all of the love. And I think what I've learned over the years is that you don't have to let go of all the love. The love can change and it can be different and it can still be there. And you can let go of one piece of it that's no longer serving you and still love.
Yeah. It's almost like a spectrum of, because I have people, you know, I have people even of the same sex in my life who I fucking love these people. Don't want to like date them. Don't want to be with them. Right. Like of opposite sex too, like, and of any gender, but like I have people that I truly fucking love. And right. Like I just love being around them and being surrounded by them. And like, I feel that warmth, right, despite not having that sort of, so it is like love is a spectrum and it's like, yeah, you're looking for,
well, this. Well, and I perfect. Think it's like, even with friends, like to your point of, I have had friends that I love, love, love deeply. And especially, I think this is, I almost feel this even more with friend related love. It's like when I was a kid, I was like, we have to be friends forever. Or or we never had a friendship. Right. We never had a real love. And it's like, people can serve you for the right moment at the right time. And you can love them at that moment in the right way. And you can move on and still love them in retrospect. Like I have friends that are no longer the right friend for me in this stage of my life in terms of the day-to-day friendship and love that comes with that, but I still love them and send them love and feel care for them. So,
and you're grateful for when they were in, yeah, they, right, when they were in your life, like you don't, mm-hmm, regret that in any way, and you kind of like might miss that, but there is a, right, reason. Like you can't maintain every friendship that you make throughout your entire life. I get that.
And I think in relationships as well too, like if you think of love in that way, you can limit yourself. You can limit, mm-hmm, the choices that you maybe want to make about a relationship of any kind, yeah, because you think it can only exist in one way. And so I think I've learned to let it be flexible.
And you can be polyamorous is what I'm hearing you say. It really encourages cheating when you think about it that way. So
let's not open that can of worms. Okay. There was a polyamorous couple that will be too excited to hear you say that. So unsubscribe. all right. Well, thanks for playing again. So much more sincere than I thought.
Yeah.
Let's roll. Welcome back to We Drink and We Watch Things. I'm Mackenzie.
I'm Lamar.
And we are running back Love Stinks Month, as we said last week, where we are talking about not quite love stories. And incidentally, also talking about books, apparently. Hence this great hat that somebody got me. Oh my God.
It's a pretty cool hat. Yeah.
Pretty cool hat. If you aren't watching this, you should check it out on YouTube or Spotify. It's a great hat that actually is so on theme for this book that we're talking about. We are talking today about Wuthering Heights. Yeah. So, and look, it matches my book, my copy of the book.
Nice, same color. It's so, like, for those that can't see, that the hat says the book was better.
Yes. And then I have the book next to the hat and they match. It's like you, it's like you were psychic. And literally you gave me this yesterday. So the timing could not be better. So anyway, I just want to shout out Lamar.
Do you want to share the other half of the story that you shared on our socials?
Oh my God. So best part, we were, actually I was dropping off ingredients, but on my way, I had picked something up at a bookstore for a friend. And I saw this book that I immediately was like, Lamar needs this. I was like, so I bought him this book and it was like, it's called I Was a Teenage Slasher. If you know Lamar, you're like, yeah, obviously he needs it. And funnily enough, it's a similar color scheme, but pink and greenish vibes. But so I go over to hand off the ingredients. I walk in and he immediately sees the book and is like shaking his head. And I'm like, what are you looking at me weird for? And he's like, I just checked that out at the library.
Yeah,
just
not only that, I had gotten my library card. I've been in Austin 13 years, and it just so happened that my primary polling place for voting this year was at a library that was like 7 minutes down the street from here. So I finished voting and then impulsively was like, I'm just going to go ahead and get my library card finally while I'm here. Got the, yeah, card, walked down the aisles for, you know, 20 minutes looking at all the different books and ended up grabbing the same fucking book literally a day before you gave it to me. So
I cannot. So the we were on the same wavelength, yeah, like same color scheme, getting each other random gifts. That's the other thing. Yeah. Like, it was so fortuitous, but yeah, tell me you don't know your,
if you've ever thought like, oh, is there drama on this pod? There is not. We get on pretty well.
Yeah. We like to fight about movies, but that's it. Come on, mm-hmm, you know, which it sounds like we're going to do today.
At least a little bit, yeah.
Okay. So to get us through this, what are we drinking?
Well, you came up with this one and we are calling this one just simply Yearning. We were going to go bittersweet yearning, but I feel like yearning gets the kind of the point of this film.
Gets the job done. Yeah.
So this is, I'll walk you through sort of the process. You're going to need to chill a coupe in advance of this, a coupe glass, and you're going to need to make some honey simple syrup. If you don't already have that, that's just half water, half honey. You heat it up and mix it together, but you're going to need to take 2 ounces of scotch, 1 ounce of fresh lemon, 1/2 ounce of, you guys know, I never know how to say this. So cream of cases, having since.
Creme de cassis.
And then 1/2 ounce of that honey simple syrup that I mentioned earlier, as well as 2 dashes of Peychaud's. I'm getting so classy.
I'm being dramatic.
Okay. Bitters, but you put that all into a glass with some ice, stir it all up, and then you will take a smoker and smoke that coupe glass that you chilled earlier, and then strain this drink into that smoky glass. And it does actually make a difference. If you don't have a smoker, sorry to hear it, but it does make
and
a difference
in the
actual flavor.
And do it with a sweet chip, not a savory wood chip.
You said like
chip.
Apple wood or something
like
that.
Like apple, so. Cherry, yeah.
Yeah, it definitely adds something to the flavor. So put that in there, and then you're going to garnish it with a dark red maraschino cherry, which is what we got here. So yeah,
there we
looks
go.
Good. Looks real good.
Cheers. I did go get, I've been actually wanting these for a while, but I did go get this glass for this purpose. I had a vision. Y'all, obviously I made it complicated. I was like, I'm going to make the most complicated recipe possible. But I think it came out good. What do you think?
I dig it. The cream de cassis is doing some heavy lifting in there. Is cassis like a blackberry? Is it currant? Like
it's a blackberry currant mix usually, okay. But I think the methyled version is blackberry only.
Okay. It's definitely very blackberry-esque, which I like. So
yeah. Well, you know, again, the darkness, the yearning, the goth, we're doing the things with the Wuthering Heights. Okay. So we're going to go through some basics and then we're going to get into the good stuff. And by good stuff, I mean, apparently we're going to argue. I will start out, I'm not going to wear this the whole time because you guys, my hair is going to go flat if not, but I will say this is both accurate and inaccurate in terms of the book was better. I would say the book was different. Okay. If you went into this expecting the book to be the movie, you were setting yourself up for failure, which I think also, to be fair, from the trailer was quite clear. A friend of mine and I had this conversation. It's like, as soon as we saw the trailer, we're like, this is not going to be a faithful adaptation.
I was going to say, isn't there isn't there some drama around the fact that, correct me if I'm wrong, because I've never read Wuthering Heights, but in the original literature, isn't Heathcliff a cat? Isn't there some drama around him not being a cat in this?
There's drama around him being white. LOL. He is not a feline.
Okay. Yeah, maybe my sources are unrelated. Off as far as
you just have a cat brain now. Post Gambit. It's all about the cats. All about the cats. No, there's a lot of drama. We'll get into it. I won't bore you all too much, but I will highlight, I think, some key things that I think make a difference. One of the things that I think might set the tone here is that Emerald Fennell said that this was not so much an adaptation as it was a response to Wuthering Heights, which I think makes you frame it up a little bit different in your mind. Like I didn't hear her say that before I saw it, by the way. I would go rewatch it with that in mind and probably have a different experience, you know?
Yeah. I mean, without spoiling anything, my early opinion and probably the place where we'll disagree is that I don't know jack shit about Wuthering Heights, so I don't care about whether it's loyal to the book or not. I went into this, and the reason I was so hyped to see it was when you said, oh, it's the same director as Saltburn and Promising Young Woman. I got hyped for that.
Right.
I just feel like the weakness of this film is that it doesn't lean enough. If you're going to say we're going to do a response, which gives you the out of do whatever the hell you want. To me, this movie walks a line between traditional drama, like good Oscar bait drama, versus melodrama, like over the top, what you would imagine a story like Wuthering Heights would be. And then this dark comedy, which kind of taps into the Saltburn of it all, but it doesn't lean enough into any one of them for me to have enjoyed it. That's what I'm going to complain most about today is the parts of the, there's different parts of this I like, but it doesn't feel cohesive to me.
It's so funny that you say that because like, we'll get in. Yeah. Like I don't want to go too far into the weeds, but I think those are great, excellent call outs because they're all true. In terms of like, not only what I interpreted, but also what she would say about it as well. But I liked that mix. So okay. I think it's so funny that you say that. Anyways, okay, so we'll knock out some basics. Wuthering Heights, like we said, 2026 came out this year. Came out a matter of weeks ago, like a few, couple weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. Came out for Valentine's Day, which I find so inappropriate and ironic, but deeply hilarious in other ways. I went and saw it that week, which is the week of my birthday, which is more important than Valentine's Day, if you ask me. Mm-hmm. So that was one of my birthday gifts to myself. And I was like, all the couples there, I was like, you guys, this is not what you should be doing with your Valentine's Day date. I need you to understand. But choices were made. So it's a 6.3 out of 10 on IMDb. So people kind of vibing with you a little bit. Critics super vibe with you. 58% from critics, not fans. 77% from audiences, though. I think the precursor that I will tell you is that while I really like it as a piece of literature, like something to read and interpret and analyze, these are terrible people. Like, yeah. I need everyone to understand the baseline. Like, that is the point. Everyone in this book is terrible. And what the reactions to this film have taught me is that nobody read the fucking book.
Everyone misreads it. Yeah.
Yeah, because people were like genuinely going to the, and not even misreading the book, which
misreading the film, like misreading that this is meant to be right. Some sort of typical romance. No.
Exactly. Of like, they, I feel like from the trailer, it's actually clear to me, and maybe it helps again that I've read the source material, but to me, it was clear that it's not a traditional love story. This is not a rom-com. It's not going to go well, right? And people, the reactions in the theater, online, in the reviews, are people like up in arms that this film turned out to be what it was. And I'm like, number one, they're supposed to be terrible. Number two, not a one of you have read the fucking book. So anyways, our director here, like we said, is Emerald Fennell. She did Promising Young Woman, as you said, and Saltburn, which to me both are like, Promising Young Woman is just fucking excellent, if you ask me. And then Saltburn is, I think, also very good, but very divisive, very controversial. And then the source material here is Emily Brontë's novel, like we said, which, again, I just want to take a moment for, look at this beautiful edition of this book. Like, it's even soft to the touch. It's got dye on the pages on the side.
It's not made of like Margot Robbie's skin.
It is not, but it is beautiful. This is a very, I feel like this one is very complimentary to the production design of this film, I will say. Anyway, so she writes a source novel, which is a gothic novel. It was very controversial when it came out, which we'll talk about another time. And then, of course, Emerald Fennell adapted the screenplay. For those that don't know, her background is in literature. So she has a degree, I want to say it's from Oxford, could be Cambridge. So she has studied this book, and it's actually her favorite book. So I think that should tell us a lot about Emerald, if I'm being honest with you. Another thing I want to call out is that Margot Robbie executive produced this as well. And I think in all the interviews that I watched and read, it very much comes off as a partnership to me and a real true collaboration between Emerald Fennell and Margot Robbie. Of like, if this feels like their project that they did together.
Didn't they collaborate in some capacity, like production on either Promising Young Woman or Saltburn too? I remember when we talked Barbie, there was some sort of like
I want to say it was both, but yes, yes, they did. She did produce. She didn't appear. So, I mean, I think they work really well together and they complement each other's style really well together. But I just, you'll hear me as we go through this rave about the women involved in this production and the production value of this film. Cause I think that even if you don't like the end result, is pretty,
I'm on board with that. I will
pretty much just facts. The production is just very well done. So, okay. So our cast here, Margot Robbie, like I said, she plays Kathy, our lead, who is objectively the worst person, but she's done Barbie, I, Tonya. We've talked about her a bunch. Jacob Elordi, he did Saltburn, as we know. And then he most recently did Frankenstein, which we have talked about a couple times just in terms of referencing it.
I haven't seen it. Sorry. I know it's Oscar-nom. I know.
Well, it's a bummer you didn't see it in theaters because it's one of those. It's a Guillermo del Toro, and I think it's one that like that the scale
visually,
of it. Yeah, you like kind of want to see it on the screen. If it comes back to the screens, I would do that.
Both of our leads here are from Australia, which is kind of bonkers. My point being, we in America are so concerned, or not we as in you and I, Mackenzie, but people in America are so concerned about immigrants coming here and taking our jobs. We need to be less concerned about people from South America and other places that are fleeing dangerous places for better lives and better, you know, supporting their families and coming here to bust their asses and do whatever jobs they can in order to give a better life to their loved ones. We should be less concerned about that and more concerned about these attractive as fuck Australians and Irish and English coming here. Mackenzie, this could, they took our jobs. We could be in this movie. Like they took our jobs. These Australians, I'm just saying it's a concern.
This isn't, there's so this, number one, I have so many thoughts. This went so many places that I didn't think it was going to go. And I would just like to co-sign one, our immigration concerns are bullshit. Yeah. And two, say how American of you to center this in the US, because it was not filmed here. It was not produced by Americans and it wasn't led by Americans in any way.
Well, I saw it in an American movie theater. So my ignorant ass thinks that's where everything comes from.
Oh, that was so great. Thank you. Thank you You're welcome. Adding that. Okay, couple more. Hong Chau plays Nelly, who is, we probably know her from a few things like supporting roles, but I think one of her most impactful roles that I have spoken about maybe one other time is The Whale. Yeah. And it's, if you haven't seen it, man, one, see it, but two, prepare yourself. But she does an incredible job.
I liked her in that in The Menu. She was good in The Menu.
The Menu, she was so good in The Menu. Shahzad Latif has the unenviable task of playing Edgar in this film, next to Jacob Elordi, because Jacob Elordi's character of Heathcliff is just like gorgeous and perfect. But the actual good guy is Edgar, and he gets second fiddle the whole time. He is not known for a lot of mainstream things that we would know him for, but he was in the second best exotic Marigold Hotel, which is a fucking mouthful.
Does that mean there was a first exotic Marigold Hotel?
No, it means okay. Yes and no. So there was the first iteration of this film was the best exotic Marigold Hotel, and this was the sequel.
Oh, okay.
And they were actually kind of cute movies, but God, if it's not a mouthful, it was a lot. He's so great.
I don't know him from, this is the first film of his that I've seen, but I thought it was a fun fact. He was in the literal first episode of Black Mirror.
I didn't know that.
I don't think it's a major role, but that was one of his earliest roles. He was in the first episode of Black Mirror.
I've literally only seen one episode of Black Mirror and I didn't keep watching it. Martin Clunas plays Mr. Earnshaw. He's been in a lot of things, a lot of British film, but I think the thing that American audiences would know him from is Shakespeare in Love, most notably. And then lastly, we have Ewan Mitchell, who plays Joseph, who we have talked about before because he was in Saltburn as well. And then another thing he's well known for is High Life. So she has similar to some of the other directors we've talked about, I think most recently Christopher Nolan, she has, you know, her troupe of players that she likes.
Repeat performers. Yeah. Which is cool. I like that because you're working with someone, it's almost like a... when your boss moves to another company and you're willing to follow them because of how many good experiences you've had before. So it's like, oh, they know how to shape me and mold me into this character. So the only other casting notes that I had over here were, I just feel like we have to mention Alison Oliver, who I was not aware of her game coming into this movie, but she plays Isabella.
Oh, I'm sorry. You're right. I totally skipped over her. I do have her on here. Isabella. Yes.
Like I know she was in Saltburn and she's in that show Task, which I haven't watched yet, but this just feels like this could be a breakout role for her.
This character had none of this depth in the book. Like this, the way, and I know it's partially the direction and the screenwriting that tells us a different story here than in the book, but she fucking took it and ran, because this character is wildly unobtrusive in the book, really. And she's a key pawn in the chess game that is happening here, but she does not have any real agency. And I think what's interesting in the film is that she gains not only agency, but a very interesting take on where this character goes. So, she does a great job.
I could see that if I read the book, I could see how she could just very easily be a plot device that is kind of used as leverage in the story. I really like the way that she comes off here. The only other two I was going to call out was our child actors here. So Owen Cooper, who apparently I have to fucking watch Adolescence. Everyone's talking about Adolescence on Netflix. Supposed to be a really great show. Won a bunch of Emmys. So that's on my list. And then Charlotte Mellington, who plays young Kathy. This is her first role. So let's see where she goes. I think she does fine, given what she's given.
They both do a great job. And one thing I will say on that note is that Margot Robbie was interviewed talking about a number of things. But one of the things she mentioned was that at the first table read, she was so impressed by both of them. Hmm. And a lot of times, you guys, just so if you don't know, the first table read is like people getting a feel for their characters, getting a feel for how they're going to complement each other's performances, maybe. It's a bit more casual. And what she was saying was that they just came with their A game and like ready. Hmm. And she was like, it woke her up, where she was like, ooh, I got to like get to their level. So I think we don't always give child actors as much credit as we should. They really showed up and did the work here.
I think she's okay.
Well, they collectively, I think they complement each other really well.
I respect. However old she is, I could not do this kind of performance. So like sometimes I think I expect personally a little too much of child actors, and it's just like
you do historically have that.
Wish it was like Shakespeare times and we just had adults playing like all the roles. Mm-hmm. It's just like I am an 8-year old boy, but like
we talked about this in Hamnet though. Those child actors were like wildly good. That's what you want every time, is that level of performance every single time.
Yes.
Okay, quick plot summary and then we'll get into some more deets. So a passionate and tumultuous love story set against the backdrop of the Yorkshire Moors, exploring the intense and destructive relationship between Heathcliff and Catherine Earnshaw.
Yeah.
Very accurate. Very accurate. Destructive AF, for sure. What I will say is that there are a ton of things that happen in this interpretation of this novel that do not exist. Where Isabella's character goes, where the Heathcliff and Kathy relationship goes, both emotionally and physically. The thing that you have to understand about Gothic literature in particular, and literature of this era, is that you don't say those things out loud. Like, some of the stuff that we see materialize on the screen does not happen in the novel. You're supposed to understand this relationship as very much an unrequited love, for sure. But it is almost barely stated. It's much more overt in this version than it could possibly have been in 1847. So I will just say that. Fennell took the opportunity to rewrite this story for contemporary audiences.
It feels a little Saltburn-y. It feels a little parts 50 Shades of Grey. It does feel very contemporary in that capacity, for sure. Did you throw down a spoiler warning already? I might have missed that.
I did not. Turn around. Don't drown. It's spoiler time.
Okay. The reason I wanted to throw that down was I was going to ask you, in the book, is there a bit for a horse? Like, how much horseplay is addressed in the novel? Because I just...
Oh, God. Not there. Yeah, no, there's not.
Do you think horseplay is the organic official word for it? If people are into like horse related kinks, it's
got to be horseplay,
which is great.
Is it horseplay? I feel like I'm thinking of a worse word that I am hesitant to say, but I think it's a no. I think it's a no.
Fair. So where do you want to start with this one? Like, do you want to just do overarching viewpoints, or like, do you want to start plot wise?
Yeah. So I want to talk about a couple of things. Like I said, this is a Gothic representation of a love story that was never really a love story. Mm-hmm. I think what she does here is deeply stylize a classic to, again, make it relatable and contemporary, but she doesn't really want it to be rooted in one specific period. So I think what a lot of audiences can have trouble with is this disconnect between where the era you think you're in and the movie you walk into, you know? The aesthetic is different. The boundaries between the people are challenging. The evolution of the characters is different. The set design and the production and the environments that you're in are, I think, are all a little bit unexpected. Okay. But one of the things I think I really love about it is the production design and value of this film. I love where and how it is shot. I think the cinematography here is incredible in almost every scene, cutting across the moors. The picture of Margot Robbie's character walking to her wedding, as though it's a funeral, by the way, across the moors and in the wind, is incredible. These low light shots in dining rooms, the scale of the, you know, Thrushcross Grange as a dollhouse, but also a real house, and how symbolic that is, and complementary that is to the motifs of the story. I think there's so much thought and intentionality put into Emerald's version of this story that it makes it compelling. I don't think it makes it consumable to all audiences, but I think it makes it compelling. It's a compelling watch.
I will say it's compelling from a visual sense, so I'll give you that. I don't think it, like you said, I don't think it makes for a great film, but the one thing that I immediately like typed into my phone after I got out of this was like, visually fucking incredible. Not just to your point, you have these sweeping, incredible shots of nature and like the greenery and the fog and the wind, and it's these incredible on the rocks there on like the ridge of just how beautiful this all looks. And meanwhile, you also have these incredible interior shots of the both the kind of dilapidated home of Kathy and her family versus her husband, Edgar, in his mansion. And you see these shots in there. It's almost like the house itself is a character in this, and every room is kind of different. There's some incredible just looking pieces where they're either sitting at the dinner table or there's two people talking and just the backdrop is this random room behind them that we've only seen in this one scene of the film. There's the overhead stair shot near the end where Heathcliff is coming in, and it's these white stairs leading up to this black floor, dark floor. And then there's the red hallway as he's, there's some really beautiful stuff in here.
I think you hit the nail on the head, and I want to expound on the fact that the house is a character, but so is almost every environment that we're in, right? Mm-hmm. The house at Thrushcross Grange is a character, but so is Wuthering Heights. So are the moors. And these are all wildly different representations of the phases of these characters' lives. And I think what you see is a direct juxtaposition of the Wuthering Heights environment to what Kathy chose. I think that's a very, the disparity there is so extreme, and it's intentional, right? Because at the crux of this story, you have a woman who is making a choice that is in direct opposition to her feelings about Heathcliff. But he is, at that point, a stable boy, a servant, a friend, whatever. He's not somebody that can pull her family out of poverty. They may have a good reputation, but they don't have any money, right? Like, she's going to very potentially starve and die. And I think that the contrast there is stark and intentional, right? To understand the wealth of Edgar as it relates to the poverty of Kathy is so critical to understand the decisions that she makes, because it's very easy to hate her. She's not likable. She's not likable in the book either, right? She is vain and selfish, and she thinks she's the best thing that, you know, walked the earth. She thinks she's spoiled, right? But one, Heathcliff's the only one who sees her as exactly that and seems to love her anyway. And two, she does ultimately make what is relatively selfless decision-making for her in choosing to marry Edgar, because she doesn't love him. And it's for the benefit of course, her, but also her family. And it's not totally selfless, but I mean, relative to Kathy as a character, her choosing not to do the thing that she just wants to do, which is be with the person that she loves, probably, she decides to do the thing that is the most advantageous. And you're supposed to see what that means in this other house. There's crystal on the wall. There's gilded silver walls. The production value, again, we have to talk about here. Like, the way that they built this set, this is a fully functional leveled set. This is all studio built in terms of the house. They have hand gilded the walls with silver. They have added crystal to the walls. They have the chandelier is held up by these gothic looking hands that you don't actually ever really see. The chandeliers are made up of forks and knives that are holding or candelabras that are holding themselves together. Like there's such incredible detail to the wealth that is being shown to us so that we understand what a decision it was to go there versus stay in poverty with Heathcliff.
I get that. And I mean, the film and I assume the book do a good job of getting that across, that this is not what Kathy wants, but it's what she feels is her obligation, because she immediately said, like, the day she accepts the proposal, she realizes it's a mistake. She doesn't want to do it. Right.
Right.
I just love that we live in this world where they're doing their best here to dress down Margot Robbie and be like, wow, no, who would want to marry her? And they do like kind of have her go through a
That's bit not of a- the point, though, in the book or really generally in this story. Like, she is the most beautiful thing around, but she's poor.
So nobody's going to marry her because they feel like they would be taking her out of squalor.
She doesn't have a dowry, you know, she doesn't have anything to offer. She has a name and name only. Like, her family is, quote, respectable in terms of her breeding, right? But they don't have wealth. Her dad is gambling away any and all money they ever had. So it is and is not a reflection on her, the woman. Like, the likelihood of her making a match was limited, but not impossible, because she's not supposed to be homely in any way. She's supposed to be charming, but...
You can tell that, like, you know, Emily Bronte never watched Aladdin. It shows. Because I feel like if she had seen Aladdin, she would get that it's possible for, like, a street rat to marry a prince. Anyway. Sorry. I'm, like, diverting us. But
I didn't expect, I guess, Aladdin, to your point. The Aladdin Wuthering Heights crossover was not on my bingo card today. I'm going to be honest with you.
I mean, basically, Aladdin is just an inverted Wuthering Heights with a genie. It's a pretty simple plot for plot, like beat by beat story. They don't die at the end. But anyway, you said something about Kath being the most unlikable. And I don't know that a lot of people see that, to my point earlier. I think people are misreading this and miswatching this. The number of people that I saw crying on their way out of this, I went, how can
sobbing,
you be rooting?
Truly sobbing.
For these characters. This is like, to me... rooting for Ryan Phillippe and Sarah Michelle Gellar to end up together in Cruel Intentions. Like, they're shitty fucking people. And, like,
that's
why are we
upset? Analogy, especially in terms of source material, actually.
Right?
Dangerous Liaisons, which it's close, but I will digress on one point. There is, you are supposed to accept that they're terrible, but you are not supposed to not want them to find some kind of happiness.
That's
like, you're supposed
I
to understand that it's unattainable.
Wall.
Yeah, but you're not supposed to, like, you're not supposed to be rooting against them, I guess is the thing I would say.
My big takeaway, before I forget, I do want to circle back to something you said about Kath being bad. But my takeaway was just this is a movie of people, we could talk about how it's tragic that they can't be together. And maybe this is just the source material, but it's also infuriating to watch this because they're just being incredibly spiteful and shitty to each other throughout. And every time it seems like there might be an opportunity for them to reconnect, one does hold something over the other one's head. And it's meant to be this sort of passionate romance, right? Not a romantic romance where, like, they think that's what it is, but it's really just this very hot and, like, spicy and inappropriate and, like, fucked up sex on a Viking ship relationship. Like, it's burning. That is what this is. It is not a we're going to end up together forever and ever type thing. So,
but I think you are fundamentally, and I say this with all the love and respect to my heart, I think you're fundamentally misunderstanding the source material, not only the source material, but also what this story is trying to do. And okay. I think it's, by the way, a reflection of, I don't think it's off base in terms of how you could come into this and react to it. I don't think it's wrong, but I think what is being misunderstood is not only that these characters are not perfect, they're terrible. but also that they are a product of their time, a product of their environment. And for better or worse, these two people in these really terrible circumstances do love each other and have made mistakes in recognizing that relationship in any capacity. The Nelly scene where Nelly and Kathy are talking and she says the thing about Heathcliff. Listen, I do not subscribe to this book as a romance, but that is the most romantic thing I think you could say about a person, right? Of like, he's more myself than I am. She is a deep, deep actual love for him. She made this obnoxious choice to go be with this guy for, in theory on and on paper, wealth and security and blah, blah, blah. But she's coping with that decision the entire time. You see her in these beautiful environments and these gowns and these diamonds and like, the production value and the costumes, incredible. But she is thinking about him the entire time. You know, she deeply regrets her decision to marry this person, no matter how beautiful her life is. So in its own way, she is being punished. She is in her own form of misery, no matter how gilded the cage. She made the wrong decision. She loved this man. He can't be for her. And you mentioned something there of the passionate romance. We have to separate the two environments. Like in the movie, absolutely, they're giving you the thing that the book doesn't give. Like there's no passion to this in the book. In the movie, you go on a totally different journey with these two characters of this like spicy, passionate romance. And I think what it's doing in some ways is doing a disservice to that this isn't just a hot affair and it is somebody that I actually loved. Does that make sense?
That part makes sense. I mean, agree to disagree on the them being bad people, but it's still okay to root for them. The way that they treat each other, it feels like maybe it's just this adaptation of it, but like the fucked up things that they do to each other in this. And I'm thinking of Heathcliff, the way he treats Isabella, and she seems more, I guess, on board with it in this telling than I would assume it is in the book. But like, he's doing some really fucked up stuff. And it's like, why do I want either of these people to end up happy just because they love each other? No, like I fucking Bonnie and Clyde or like Natural Born Killers. Those characters loved each other, but they're horrible people. So at the end of this, I don't want them to be happy together. I'm not heartbroken when Kath dies. I don't care how Heathcliff feels because I've watched them treat each other like shit and everyone around them like shit. So for me, it just doesn't land, but maybe that's the point.
I wasn't devastated. I was in the movie or in the book. I wasn't devastated when she died. I think that's actually for me where maybe the story lands on screen, because I don't think I had the same emotional reaction to the source material either, actually, that maybe is even intended, because I accept that they're not great people. And, you know, what is the argument for everybody deserves happiness versus not? Heathcliff in the book is so much worse. They actually really deeply toned it down for the movie. Like he beats a dog and a child and like he's terrible. What doesn't happen in the book is the BDSM dynamic between him and Isabella in the movie I actually love, because it feels like it's rooted again in some agency on Isabella's part. In the book, it doesn't exist. She's basically a prisoner, right? She's basically miserable. No, she was.
I like that they give her, they have her asking, and I don't like use this term lightly, but she's asking for some of this. Like she's asking right. for it of like, I am she's willingly taking part.
She's
in
a
this.
Participating yeah. submissive. She's a part of this process in an intentional way. And so she is not a victim. In the book, she is a victim. I like that those two things were upended here, personally. But I do think he's so much worse. That actually gives him some credibility here in the movie that didn't exist in the book. You know what I mean? Like, this is a mutually beneficial relationship in the movie versus in the book. He's just a fucking shithead to her. He really is.
Yeah.
but it's all in service. And this is not making an excuse because I completely understand everything you're saying. What I think is true in both the book and the movie is that this is rooted in heartbreak. And not to oversimplify things, but hurt people hurt people. And he is heartbroken at her decision to marry Edgar. And again, because the connection is so deep and so sincere, and to have that be rejected out of hand is so hard for him to reconcile, I think. And she does it too, right? He shows up, he's basically there with his revenge bod, his revenge look, his revenge money, having the vibes, right? And so
revenge
earring, revenge gold tooth, revenge all the things. I didn't need
him to have an earring. That felt weird to me, except for the joke about being
a pirate. You are incorrect, sir. Like, you are incorrect.
The pirate joke landed because of that, but I'm like, I don't need him to have an earring to show how
his whole vibe was super hot. That's actually false. Okay. But
you like the gold tooth too? Should he have gotten a grill, a full-on Nelly grill?
No, just the one, like a little sparkle. Like, just the one sparkle was good. I just mean, I think he comes in, he's doing his revenge bod, his revenge thing.
Yeah.
But all of it is like, I loved you. You rejected me. Let me show you what you were missing. You didn't know that I could go be the thing that you needed and that you wanted and give you the security and the money and all the things that you wanted. You never gave me the chance. And I went and did it anyway. And I think it's a rejection of, she made a lot of assumptions and she never gave him a shot. And he's bitter and angry but about
does
that.
Does he even become that person if she doesn't shoot him down?
I think that's possible, right? I think it's like
if she had just the right stayed there kind of, and not married him, he would just still probably be working in the stables like yearning.
Well, I think he wanted her to marry him is the point, right? Mm. It's like if the right relationship and the right person motivates you both out of anger, it can also motivate you out of love. I think he feels like he could have done this for her no matter what. And she didn't let him do it. She didn't give him the chance. And so he's angry and bitter about that. She's angry and bitter that she can't have her cake and eat it too, because she is spoiled and awful. She wants him to come back and still be her best friend and be obsessed with her, but also let her be married to this man. And like, you can't have both. And so she acts awful to him as well. But then they have this period in the film that doesn't happen in the book where they have a full-blown affair.
That doesn't happen in the book?
No, that is the biggest departure for me. And I actually don't think it's bad. I think it gives you something that the book doesn't in terms of giving you a reason, you know, for all of this pain and all of this
That's kind trauma. Of what I was hinting at earlier when I said this leans into like four different genres, but none of it enough. And to me, it doesn't gel the way that it does for you. And I wrote down, I went into this based on the reviews and things that I had heard of just like, oh my God, this is like a, you know, 1800s, 50 Shades of Grey. Like, it's a sexy movie. And then I walked out and I was like, it's really only sexy for like 20 minutes during that affair thing. Outside of that, it's a very just sort of like, again, spiteful.
Well, it's the yearning story of it all, right? Yeah. It's the buildup of tension. And I actually loved the way that Emerald Fennell spoke about this in an interview that I watched, where she was talking more specifically about any and all films and direction as a whole, of like, you have to break the tension in some way. In some ways, it's a dark laugh or it's a kiss. It's some kind of release. It can't go on for forever. And they have multiple small releases early on, but the tension is still just like building throughout between the two of them, especially when he comes back and he looks the way that he looks, right? And he's got the money that he's got and the potential is there in the back of her mind. And she's regretting her choice now for a different reason. You have to release that tension in some way or another. And I think that's a bit of the payoff you don't get in the book. But I wouldn't say that it's perfect in the way that it plays out. I think it's very cinematic. She turns this into a slightly different story than I expected, certainly, and moves away from characters that you don't get enough time with, but still acknowledges their contributions, the Edgars and the Nellies of the world who were instrumental in the way that this plot goes. You know, Nellie in the book is a narrator. She is one of the secondary narrators in the book, and she's telling her experience with these same events, and she's trying to do it as a guide to a visitor that makes it really interesting for you to come in cold to this relationship and this dynamic, but it leaves out in the film the ghost story aspect of it all, which I think is a key part of like the gothic energy of this story.
What's the ghost story?
It's supposed to be that that Kathy really haunts him. And what?
Oh, so the story doesn't end in this when the credits end, like, or credits start.
No, it doesn't end in the same way. It's supposed to be that he is mentally and potentially physically very haunted by the ghost of Kathy. Hmm. She does die in childbirth, similar but different in the way of the book. And they do end up together in a different way. I like this interpretation of it, but what I would say is that I think that they're both haunted by each other, both in life and in death. And that is the one thing I think doesn't quite come through.
Well, maybe, is there any chance that Emerald is just saving footage for the sequel and we're going to get a Wuthering Heights 2? Wuther harder. I'm just throwing it out there. It could happen.
That sounds terrible. Do you know what I expected, though, almost? Was a Saltburn grave scene.
Like a humping the grave? Why not? Run it back. It was very impactful the first time.
He is buried next to her in the book. And instead, they show him laying on her dead body and kissing her, which is very morbid and visceral in its own right. But he is very preoccupied with being with her for eternity. And he wants to be buried next to her. And he actually digs up her body in the film to see it one last time.
That's when you kept using the word horror a few times throughout this pod. And I was like, I don't see it. But when you're talking about these components now, it makes a lot more sense.
Which is all this to say, I think part of the reason I'm able to enjoy the film as a film, which is, I think, very atypical when we reference The Hat or the book was better. Mm. I think this is one of those where knowing and understanding the source material actually, for me, helped me appreciate this interpretation of it. That's while bad. It being fundamentally different.
Speaking of that, there's some in the back half of the film, mainly like the last hour, there's some story connections that don't, or the way that she's telling the story don't totally make sense to me. I don't love the multiple sequences where I guess Catherine is hallucinating that Heathcliff is with her there. We have the hand under the bed. We have when she's imagining that her husband is actually Heathcliff and he's sort of talking her through her sickness and stuff. I didn't love that because we hadn't really established any of that earlier in the movie. So like it took me out of it. And I was like, wait, what am I supposed to believe here? Even backtracking to when we see Heathcliff mistreating Isabella and she's writing the letter about how fucked up he is and he's doing all these terrible things. And then the next scene is like, no, she's actually okay with this. She wants to sleep with him. So she's playing along and writing these letters of her own volition. Like those storytelling components, in a way, it's kind of a neat twist, but at the same time, it made it on a first watch through kind of hard to know what to believe. Because after that point, I'm like, well, now I'm watching every scene, not sure if I'm watching what I'm watching, if it's real.
I think you're supposed to be confused in that way, I will say, because I think you're supposed to appreciate that. So the way that she dies in this film is actually, I think, arguably more visceral than in the book, because you see her hunger strike, as it were, and like it's like a slow burn of where she ends up. And I think it's impactful because it's rooted in, it's almost like, for me at least on this watch, it's almost like she's rejecting her reality. It's like a breakdown of her choices and her reality. And it's a mental breakdown, I think, in the purest form of, this is not what I meant to do. This is not what I want. And I am going to reject it at a cellular level. And she's then ill as a result of that. And so I think that's, it almost is more tangible than in the book, where it feels very sudden that she dies in childbirth. And his devastation in the book becomes even more profound in the film because he's literally running to see her before she dies and trying to be with her in these last moments. Because at the end of the day, with all the games and the revenge and the you did this to me and you did that to me, da da da. At the end of the day, what it came down to is I wanted to be with this person. I didn't get that chance. And now I'm not going to get to explain to her or explain to him what this should have been. And so that part made the unrequited love story, I think, more impactful in the film of adding that cinematic angle to it.
I mean, that's a fair interpretation. Maybe it would have helped if I didn't literally watch Hamnet like a month ago and see the sort of reality juxtaposed with, I don't want to spoil anything from that, but like reality juxtaposed with like this dreamscape type world, not to give anything away. But I feel like it did it so much better. Whereas in this, it felt a little out of left field and mishmashed. And to go along with that, I didn't love, and this might be a product of the novel again, but some of the writing in this, again, in the back half, it just feels like is unearned. I don't like that Nelly, after fucking over Kath the whole movie and both of them kind of hating each other, then at the end when she's dying is like, I thought I meant to do this, blah, blah, blah. Like, I didn't. It just feels, again, melodramatic of like, I like that at least Nelly owns it and says like, yeah, I did mean to do this to you. I feel kind of bad. I'm crying now. Like, that makes it a little better, but I don't like that Kath forgives her when she's fucking dying because of it. And same with the whole Kath telling Nelly when they're, you know, teenagers or in their 20s, and when Heathcliff overhears the conversation of like, it would degrade me, and then he runs away, and immediately then she says, oh, but it's a shame because I love him. And then however many years later, he comes back and he's like, I heard you. You said I would degrade you. And she's like, well, no, you should have stuck around because then I said I loved you. And he goes, oh, okay, let's kiss. It feels very melodramatic, and I'm probably simplifying it. But to me, that was just like not earned.
Well, it's a good call out because I think it doesn't maybe hold up under a modern lens. In a gothic lens, which is what this novel is a bit, it happens that way. It is very melodramatic of she did say these things very similarly. He did want her to just love him. He is that angry. He does want to forgive. Those things are melodramatic in the book. They just are. And I don't think the way that we present them here gives you enough context to that,
right,
to help you understand why it gets to that point and why they are that way. Especially with Nelly. I think Nelly's a great call out of the relationship with Nelly is very strong and very important throughout. And it actually, the fact that you perceive it in the film to be rooted in she kind of hates Kath and is fucking her over the whole time is telling, because in the book she loves Kath. But she's very irritated by her, for sure. The things about Kath that are true are just true. She's selfish, she's vain, she's all these things. But somehow she has a dynamic that makes her loved by the people in her life, including Nelly. And Nelly feels bad about that moment in the book. But I can see how she presents as semi-one-dimensional in the film.
I mean, it might just be a product, again, of watching something that's based on literature from hundreds of years ago. Because I was going to bring this up earlier, but when we talk about misreadings and how you can read something differently now, when people look at Romeo and Juliet as one of like a classic romance story. Mm-hmm. And then when you think about the fact that it's about like 13-year-old kids and literally before this double suicide ending, spoiler for Romeo and Juliet, doesn't end happily. Like a week before this, Romeo was in love with another girl and she breaks his heart. And he's like, oh my God, she had the prettiest face. I'll never forget her. And then he sees Juliet and he's like, I like her now. It's meant to be kind of a roll your eyes at young romance, young love, right?
Well, it's every 14-year-old boy ever. So, right. Yeah.
So I feel like it's kind of a similar thing where people are watching this and thinking it is this great love story. And that's not at all what it's supposed to be. But I also don't think this was the best way of telling this story. So I'll need to watch either another version of Wuthering Heights or just read the fucking book. But yeah, I think I'm missing something.
Well, I also think it is actually very hard to disassociate the two, I will say, because I want to be clear. I didn't walk out of this movie going, I loved that.
Okay.
I didn't. I walked out of the movie with a lot of questions. I would say I was not the person sobbing at the end of the film. There were a lot of them, to be clear. And it made me laugh. Like, why did nobody see this coming? So I think partially the seeing it coming changes the experience. But they change things that are really difficult to watch be changed in real life. Like the BDSM thing between him and Isabella is big, although it almost gives him more credibility than in the book. He is worse in the book because it's not a mutual agreement. He is abusing her and he is also abusing everyone and everything around him. He is so angry in this deep-seated, vengeful way in the book that the film version of him comes off as more romantic. Right? Like gentler and more romantic. Yes, angry and there for revenge, but like light, like a revenge light, right? And so for me as a watch, it feels a bit more consumable, even though there's these big, massive changes. And then I think the other thing that is just genuinely fun to watch that we haven't talked about at all is the sexy part of this film. There is this intent to give a payoff here that does not happen in the book, right? And that to me is Emerald Fennell reading Wuthering Heights 50 times and not getting the result that she wanted from it. Not
all the buildup and you're not getting the climax, pun intended. Right. Yeah.
You get no payoff to this sexual tension and this love. And I think she studied it, she's read it, and she's been like, I need this fanfic, basically. This is Wuthering Heights fanfic. And she is going, they need to at least in their lifetime have felt physical and emotional connection with each other that they don't get in the book.
Well, to our point last week during Rules of Attraction, right? It's like, are you in love with the idea of what this is going to be? Or once you attain it, is it no longer as enchanting to you? So I think it does make sense in this context of this movie.
But it also upends the point of this book, right? I totally agree with you. And that's what I think I struggled with walking out of it, of going is like, was that the intent of this story really? Should it have been that you get the payoff that you get here? Because here it is presented as they have a full-blown mutual affair. At the end of the day, they are in love with each other. They get to experience that physically. That is a payoff that you do not get in the book. And in the book, they are both haunted by one another in a way that does not manifest in the film. And I think that is why I left the story going as a film. This is really visually stunning and it's well performed and it's an interesting departure. But was that the point of the book? But I think I enjoyed how it was made and the performances. And I thought it was at least a very compelling interpretation of the story.
I mean, I guess to my knowledge, Jacob Elordi was not alive at the time that Emily Bronte was alive. So she didn't get to see him in the pictures. And I think if she had, she would have been like, you know what? I need to put more of his tongue in the story. Or maybe like he puts a thumb in Kath's mouth. Like that would be pretty hot. So
listen,
if you're going into this for the steam, you're gonna fucking enjoy 30 minutes of steam, but that's about all you're gonna get in my opinion. Sorry, what were you gonna say?
I was gonna say, if you're here for the hotness, exactly. Like it's there. But I didn't even necessarily expect that. And that's one thing I will say from the trailer is like, it doesn't let you know if it's for sure going to happen or not. And the fact that it did for sure happen, even just a kiss, was surprising to me. And I wasn't sure, but there were so many scenes. Like there are all these, like when he lays over her, when she's looking down at the other couple and he puts his hand over her mouth and her eyes.
That was,
sir.
I'm not
nothing happens in that scene. And I was like, I need a minute.
I'm going purely off of what I've heard from female friends and also from the TV show Big Mouth, which as I know is scientifically accurate. But like, it's like sometimes the difference between men and women is men, when the things they think are sexy are very straightforward. It's just very visually appealing. It's like the thing that they want to see is what they see. With women, a lot of times, not generalizing, but a lot of times it's more about the thought of it. And like, what could like the idea of something sexy? And I think that scene of like, they're not doing anything, but they're close to doing something. And it's like right on that edge.
But it's completely incidental.
But like, did you notice that this was
I mean, he's He's accidentally hard. Let's just get really.
Did you notice that they had him grab his crotch right after he rolls off of her? I'm like, that's
intentional. Yes, I noticed. Yes, I noticed.
Something's going on here. He is
trying to maintain her. This is the irony of this scene. He is trying to maintain and protect her innocence while simultaneously taking it from her.
Yeah.
I mean, taking it from her with him. It could have been taken from her with this couple that she's seeing that she has no emotional attachment to, right? They're doing a thing and she's like, oh my God. Instead, it's taken by his physical body on her physical body. And she is now associating him with things that she never associated him with before. Yeah. And that is a turning point in this film. And it also, it's all about that suggestion of it. And then the thing on the moors where like he goes running after her after all this has happened and he puts her fingers in his mouth. Like he is telling her over and over again. Right. I don't think that's what that one was, to be honest. But he's trying to open the door and she is struggling with the way in which her. Yeah. Yeah, way this has shifted for her, you know. So if you're there for the hotness and the sexy vibes, like it's going to deliver on that. If you're there for big production value and incredible costume and set design and strong performances, absolutely. If you want this to be rooted in a narrative structure that gives you a happy ending or a payoff that tells you that this romance was all worth it in the end, no. This is not it. This is not it. You know, you're going to leave the theater sobbing as so many people did.
I don't think they were sobbing because of the lack of narrative. I think they were sobbing because they misunderstood the narrative.
They misunderstood the narrative. Yeah. Well, that's what I mean. Of lack of narrative closure that you wanted it to be. But it's thought provoking and it's visually stunning. And I think the thing that helped me really appreciate it, the amount of research I did after the fact to try and understand what her motivations were for telling this story in the way that she did, because I was genuinely a bit confused at the choices that were made, that helped me a lot. Like there is a lot of thought and intentionality that she put into this film, as well as just the literature nerd in her that took this and ran. That I didn't see on a first watch. I would go rewatch it with that in mind and see how I receive it now, I think.
I respect the effort. I respect the creativity. It doesn't land for me personally.
Well, okay, hotness aside, it wasn't your favorite, and that's fair. What was your take? What was your rating?
Wasn't my favorite. I found it interesting talking through this because we just recorded Rules of Attraction an hour ago. So if you guys are listening to these episodes back to back, I feel like the movies are not that similar in much capacity, but I think our arguments are very similar and we're kind of trading places where both movies are about really bad people. And if you don't connect with that, or if the narrative doesn't make sense to you, or if the subject matter is like too dark compared to what you were, there's a lot of parallels there. So I feel like I'm on the inverse, which makes me actually sympathize more with your thoughts for the last episode where I'm like, I get some of the appeal, but it just feels so disjointed to me and not a cohesive story where I just wish she had Emerald had straight up leaned into the Saltburn-esque of it all, of like, I'm going to make a really dark, fucked up kind of comedy drama romance. But this feels like it weaves in and out of different things. And it wasn't easy for me to ride as a cohesive piece of art. So again, beautiful, great performance. Yeah, great, good to great performances, and really beautiful, good costume design.
Taking the kids out of it, who didn't give a good performance?
Honestly, some of Jacob Elordi's performance felt a little flat for me. Not all of it, but there were lines that I just didn't feel hit the same. One person we didn't really mention that much, I think the dad gives an incredible performance. The older actor,
he does very well.
He's great. But anyway, I'd probably end up around like a 5.5. I think a 5.5 because I think it's beautiful, but it's just to me not a cohesive film. What about you?
I do wonder how much of that is knowing the story already and being able to follow it better and draw parallels, because I didn't take away that it wasn't cohesive at all, but I can understand. I can try to conceptualize, like, separating the two and watching it cold, would that be harder and more confusing? I think that's totally fair, to be honest, because this is a very unique relationship. This is not a real love story. You know, people who were going into this wanting a love story out of it were not prepared for the reality, I think I would say. So I think I appreciate both. And for me, somehow the alchemy of the two landed, even though they were so different. I think that's because partially of how much I respect her as a filmmaker. I would say I think that's a big part of my rating. I think she is so thorough to an almost absurd degree. And I just like that level of detail and intention in your set and your costumes and your whatever, to be so heavy on the symbolism and the motifs and complementing the story is something I think is very cool. Like, just as the nerd in me thinks is very cool. So I think I would say like a 7.5, because I think this is a very well-made film. It is, you honestly made it clear how hard it is to put together as an audience member who doesn't have any of this background. I mean, that's a fair call out, you know, because I had to go digging for that. Like, help me understand what we did here. And I think that that helped.
Yeah.
All right, kids, let us know what you thought, because this was a wild ride, I think, to be fair. What's your favorite of hers? You've seen Promising Young Woman and Saltburn, right?
I think Saltburn was the most, like, enjoyable is a weird word, but like Saltburn's the one that I watch. Yeah, most entertaining. But I think Promising Young Woman is the better film.
It's a great film.
Yeah,
that's a really good one. Thanks for joining us. Come back next week, where we are going to continue Love Stinks Month and talk about one that Lamar has wanted to talk about for a hot second, 500 Days of Summer, which I haven't watched in a long time. I have seen it a couple of times, but it's been a minute, so I'm intrigued to see how that's going to go.
I'm excited for this one, because I feel like every time I've watched it has been at a different period in my life, and I interpret it, like, the character I relate to changes each time. So I'm curious to see what this next watch through is like.
Oof. Okay. Well, we'll have a lot to say there.
Yeah.
In the meantime.
In the meantime, follow us on our socials. We Drink and We Watch Things on Instagram. You can get the video of this podcast on Spotify or on YouTube, and I guess coming soon, Apple Podcasts as well.
All right, kids, for now, go have a drink and watch a thing. Cheers.
Cheers.